You probably heard a statement recently, maybe a couple of months ago, coming from the Archbishop of Canterbury, whose name is Dr. Rowan Williams, concerning the establishment of certain elements of Sharia law in Britain. Now, you know what Sharia law is. We've talked about that before. Most of you have read about it. It's Islamic law. And so the idea is that here we have a multicultural society, and because it is we live in this global community with a multicultural societies, let's accommodate other religious traditions other than Christianity. So he suggested having certain components, certain elements of Sharia law established in Britain. This means that British Muslims could then choose to have marital, for example, and financial disputes settled in a Muslim court, not in the regular British court, but in a Muslim court. And they would be accommodated in this way. So this archbishop calls this supplementary jurisdiction, and he says it is unavoidable. I'd like to take issue with that statement. I think he's tampering with something that he doesn't really know what he's tampering with there. Certain accommodations, for groups with different beliefs is one thing. I think accommodation is good. You know, various institutions accommodate for Sabbath keepers, for example. You can make up time. You can switch with other people for various jobs. That's a good thing. Accommodation is a good thing. But establishing elements of Sharia on British soil is quite another. It's quite another. So you have two legal traditions in that country that are at many points opposed to each other. And you have problems in the making. And the question I would like to ask the Archbishop is this. Where do you think it will end? Once you begin to establish elements of Sharia for the Muslims, where do you think it will stop? Do you think there will be any pressures from the Muslim community to add additional elements of Sharia? You can bet there will. Will they begin to push for more Sharia law? Will they begin to push for whole communities, Islamic communities, where Sharia law is in full force? I would say there's a good probability that along the way that would happen. Now, if the UK goes down this path of accommodation to its Muslim citizens by permitting these aspects of Sharia, again, I ask, where does it end? And what does it say for the rest of the surrounding parts of that world, of that society? What does it say for the rest of Europe? In fact, you know, there are already problems in Europe due to the imams taking on more and more responsibilities that rightfully belong to the governments there as the Islamic communities continue to grow. That's mostly, by the way, through immigration and through the high birth rate in those communities. Robert Spencer, author of several books on Islam and the Crusades, writes this. He says, some of the modern-day Islamic thinkers who are most revered today by jihad terrorists, that Islam must impose itself by force upon non-Muslims, not as a religion, for that would violate the Quran's dictum that, quote, there is not compulsion in religion, but as a system of laws and societal norms. They taught that Muslims might fight to impose Islamic law on non-Muslim states, relegating its citizens to dhimmi status or worse. That means you're either under dhimmitude, you're under Islamic rule, but you don't have to be a Muslim. You just have the honor of being under their rule and paying the tax that they require you to pay. That's dhimmi status, called dhimmitude. Or worse, that means, you know, you're put to death if you get out of line with their rule. Well, when, you know, some Muslims today already speak of Eurabia. They call Europe Eurabia because the fundamentalist faith that's growing most rapidly there, or this be a force there now, it's no longer Christianity as it once was. It's now Islam. And so they're looking at this. You look at some of these things, and it looks rather frightening. In June of 2007, an article appeared in London's Time Out magazine. Apparently, that's an entertainment magazine. When I first read the article, I thought, is this a joke? Is this a joke, or is it for real? And evidently, it's for real. This is the way the guy really thinks. And I'd like to read sections, a few sections, or at least summarize a few sections from this particular article. His name is Michael Hodges. He starts off with a scene from a future Islamic England of a condemned man being taken to be executed. And he describes the scene. He makes reference to Sultan Charles, Prince of Islam, and protector of the faithful, and so forth. A little bit of humor added in here. And he gets to the place where he's to be executed. And just before they press the button that would cause the trap door to open and the man to fall through it and hang by his neck, he says, "Okay, not really." Now get this, listen to what he says. He says, "That's a hysterical right-wing nightmare of a future Muslim London where a cruel alien creed is forced on a liberal city. A society where women are second-class citizens, same-sex relationships a crime, and Sharia law enforces terrible public disfigurement and death. But the reality is a long, long way from this dark vision." You see, we're a bunch of right-wingers if we believe that that's the way Sharia law functions. If we think the Islamic community, if it had its way in England, that these kinds of things would occur, that there would be public executions, there would be the oppression of women and forbidding of same-sex relationships, and I assure you they would. If we think that, then we're supposedly right-wingers, and this is a nightmare that we have created. The Islamists have not created it. Well, he goes on to describe what London would be like if Sharia law were established. He gives several different categories, several different aspects of society that would change. These are public health, ecology, education, food, interfaith relations, arts, social justice, and race relations. Now, you get a little bit of a clue right there in the blurb at the beginning of the article as to where he's going with this. Let me read the blurb to you. He says, "It's the capital's fastest-growing religion, based on noble traditions and compassionate principles, yet Islam can still be tainted by mistrust and misunderstanding. Here, Time Out argues that an Islamic London would be a better place." So he goes on to tell us how it would, in fact, be a better place in these various areas that he raises here, that he mentions. For example, in public health, he mentions several things. He talks about the fact that Muslims pray 5 times a day. They get down on their prayer rugs. Have you ever seen them do this? I've seen them in various public places. They're down and up and down and up and down they go. Sometimes even the elderly can get down there pretty good. And back up they go. And you see the children. This is something they do day in and day out, year after year after year. He says this would be good for our joints, make our joints supple, make us healthier, stronger muscles. You didn't know that little benefit was worked into Sharia law, did you? The second thing he mentions here is the regular washing of hands and feet before they pray. Oh, well, if we adopted the same thing, well, that would cause the spread of the superbugs in the hospitals, or if they did in London, it would cause London's hospitals to be places where those superbugs wouldn't spread so rapidly. And the third thing he mentions is the fact that alcohol is forbidden in Islam. And then he gives some statistics here on how many people die from alcohol-related deaths or alcohol-related problems every year, from accidents and diseases and so on. And all of that could be reversed. It'd be a very different society. So again, you didn't know about these benefits of Sharia law, did you? Well, it gets better than that. Ecology. Here he points out, and I didn't know this, that Muhammad was one of the first ever environmentalists. Did you know that? An environmentalist. He quotes right out of the Quran. Says the world. Muhammad says this: "The world is green and beautiful, and Allah has appointed you the guardian over it." There you have it. An environmentalist. So all you have to do is turn it over to the. He even mentions forestry and wildlife would be protected. Recycling would be going on because this is part of the way, the Islamic way of thinking. Comes right out of the Quran, based on Muhammad's own example. Maybe we need that in this country. Wouldn't that be great? Solve our ecological problems? If this became the United States of Islamerica, the problem in Anwar, they'd have no drilling up there, would they? Muslims wouldn't be drilling for oil, would they? Never have done that, have they? So that would solve that problem, wouldn't it? So again, you didn't know all these benefits were inherent in Islam, did you? Then he talks about education, how much better that would be. He admits that as far as health is concerned, is Muslims don't have the best of health. They tend to have more diseases, die younger, and so on. But that's just a societal thing. That's not because of their practices. Also, he mentions their education problems. But again, I guess we're the culprits there. Somebody else is the culprits there. Then he talks about food. The application of dietary laws all across London, he says, I'll read it as he's written it here, would free us at a stroke from our addiction to junk food. And the general adoption of South Asian diet rich in fruit juice, rice, and vegetables with occasional mutton or chicken would have a drastic effect on obesity, hyperactivity, attention deficit disorders, and associated public health problems. Then he goes on to talk about not eating in the month of Ramadan. That's the month of fasting. And how that would be good for us too, because it would instill self-discipline and courtesy and social cohesion. You know, those things you see predominantly throughout Islamic societies anyway. So all of these benefits we would have. You know, just think of it. With all that exercise, five times a day, on the prayer rug, and this Islamic diet, say you have your standard Islamic weight loss program. And if you want to really get the fat off, get the weight off, and get in shape, you got your Ramadan quick melt plan. And you can get that at a discount. Just add 1% to the demi-tax and it's yours. Can't beat that, can you? Of course, I'm being facetious. Well, he goes on to say that concerning interfaith relations, says in an Islamic London, Christians and Jews with their allegiance to the Bible and the Talmud would be protected as peoples of the book. You'd be protected. You pay the tax, of course. You'd be protected as peoples of the book. And then he talks about England's history of bigotry, especially against Roman Catholics. He says it's reasonable to assume that under the guiding hand of Islam, a civilized accommodation could be made among faith groups in London. Oh, you bet it could. Just put yourself under demitude, submit to Islamic rule, be grateful for it, and you'll probably survive. Then under social justice, he says each Muslim is obliged to pay a welfare tax of 2.5% of annual income that is distributed to the poor and the needy. And he goes on to talk about that a little bit, how that's a beneficial thing. And he said if we would do that, if London would do that, then London would become a little less cruel. And I'm reading this, I'm thinking, is this guy serious? Is this guy serious? Under race relations, he says this, under Islam, all ethnicities are equal. Once you have submitted to Allah, you're a Muslim. It doesn't matter what color you are. End of story. Well, sorry, Mr. Hodges, it's not the end of the story. First of all, Christianity has taught that for years, for centuries. Yeah, there have been problems in Christianity, but still it has been taught that all races are equal, that Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world, that he's calling unto himself all men, not just certain races and so on. And I'm correct in saying that Christianity, and when I speak of Christianity today, by the way, I want you to understand, I think I have to mention this, that I'm not attempting to define true Christianity or what we might describe as biblical Christianity. I'm using the term in its broad, general sense. But I think Christianity had something to do with ending the slave trade, did it not? You bet it did. You bet it did. Now, where did the slave trade get started? Probably a number of places. One was Arabs. Muslims were involved in the slave trade. And still, yeah, in Islamic countries, slavery is still going on. So don't give me this business about how they're just a wonderful example of a society that doesn't recognize the differences in race and they're not prejudiced and so on. Don't give me that nonsense, because that's exactly what it is. It's nonsense. Well, since 9/11 in 2001, we've all had concerns about Islam, particularly what we know as radical Islam. And I might make a distinction here. I realize that there are Muslims in this country who are absolutely opposed to, and in recent times have been speaking out against Islamofascism. There's a group called Muslims Against Sharia. They're opposed to the establishment of Sharia law. They actually teach, you know how Muslims say that the Old and New Testaments of our Bibles have been corrupted by the Christians and the Jews? Well, these people actually believe that the Quran has also been corrupted, and that those passages in the Quran advocating violence and cruelty do not belong there. They were added by somebody else. So there are Muslims who do not believe in Sharia law. There are Muslims here that do not believe in Islamofascism or terrorism or those other things. And that's fine. You know, the problem is, though, the problem is, how many Islamofascists come into this country or any other country announcing what they are? What do they pretend to be? Well, we're moderate Muslims. So the difficulty is you can't always tell them apart until it's too late. You can't always tell them. They're not going to come and announce what they are. So you kind of, on the one hand, your heart kind of goes out to those people who want to be here and have the freedom of religious expression, and that's certainly you can do that in America, and we all want that. But on the other hand, probably they should understand our concerns, because sometimes people who don't have the best of intentions come posing as one of them. Now, all that's the bad news. We could talk about the bad news all day. We could talk about the things we've just been talking about, how some would like to impose Sharia. We could talk about the rise of Islam in Europe. We could describe what is happening there and has been happening a long time, how the mosques are filling up, the churches are emptying, and so on. We could talk about these things, about the possibility of another terrorist attack, the very real possibility that someday we may be looking at a nuclear attack. All that is scary. It's very scary. But there's something else I want to share with you today, something that's happening in the Muslim world and in other places in the world that is causing some concern, perhaps distress, for the Islamic clergy. To look at the flip side of this issue for a little while. What if I were to tell you that last year in Russia, that 100,000 ethnic Muslims converted to Christianity? Would you think that's quite amazing? 100,000 ethnic Muslims, 1 year, convert to Christianity? Well, what if I told you that it's more like 200,000? Would you be amazed that that many Muslims would be converting to Christianity? It seems that we hear often about people converting to Islam. Well, what about 200,000 Russian ethnic Muslims converting to Christianity in 1 year, last year, 2007? What if I said 1 million? Well, actually, I still wouldn't be giving you the full story. According to the website Islam Watch, in Russia, some 2 million ethnic Muslims converted to Christianity last year. 2 million. In Russia alone, last year. Now again, when I speak of Christianity today, I'm using the term in its broad, general sense. Also last year, 10,000 French Muslims, according to the same source, 10,000 French Muslims converted to Christianity. 35,000 Turkish Muslims converted to Christianity. And 10,000 in India converted to Christianity. That's in addition to those 2 million in Russia. There you have 35, 40, 55,000 in those three places. And then in recent years, in Algeria, according to a report that appeared in Epicenter, a book called Epicenter by Joel Rosenberg, over 80,000 Muslims converted to Christianity. In Morocco, there's been worry expressed in some of the newspapers there, because somewhere between 25,000 and 40,000 in recent years have converted to Christianity. Since the early 1990s in Sudan, we've all heard of what's going on in Sudan, one of the worst places in the world to be if you're a Christian. In Sudan, since the early 1990s, there have been 5 million conversions from Islam to Christianity. In the UK, in spite of the archbishop's ideas about adopting certain elements of Sharia, in the UK, 200,000 in recent years have converted to Christianity. Now, how many of you are familiar with a film that's shown, especially in foreign countries, called the Jesus film? You may have seen documentaries about it on television. You may have read about it. It's something like, I'm sure it doesn't have the same quality, but something like the movie The Passion of the Christ. It shows Jesus. It shows the life of Jesus, what he accomplished, his death, his resurrection, his ascension to the Father, and so on, and the means of salvation through him. In the year 1996, it seems like it was only a few days ago, but 1996, still it's not distant past, it's recent history, the Egyptian Bible Society, yes, there's such a thing, the Egyptian Bible Society sold 3,000 copies of that film. Now, you can rest assured, in that culture, in that society, when a film like that is sold to one person, that's not going to be the only person who sees it. That's 3,000 copies of the Jesus film. That's 1996. 4 years later, the year 2000, would you believe that more than double that number of the Jesus film were sold? Yeah, quite a bit more. In fact, 600,000 copies were sold. Think of how many people must have seen that film in Islamic countries. You don't think it just stayed in one household, do you? Oh, no. No. In fact, you know, I have seen documentaries on this or films about it, about the Jesus film. And I've seen where it was being shown and a whole village was out watching it together. And you could see those people who were born in ignorance, brought up in ignorance, in their backward religions. And as they watched the story, they were evidently comprehending it. I'm sure that parts of it were wrong. I'm not, you know, but they comprehended the idea that God sent his son into this world to die for their sins. And you could see those people, and they had tears streaming down their faces. Quite moving, and quite a different story than the other side of how Islam is taking over. Seems that something else is going on here. In Iraq, according to Islam Watch, the website, since the major combat operations ended there, some 5,000 Iraqi Muslims have converted to Christianity. Now, in 2001, there was an interview with a leading Saudi cleric that was aired on Al Jazeera. I read an English transcript of that interview. And he said that he expressed concern over this. Now, there's no way that these numbers can be confirmed or denied. We just don't have the means of knowing for sure if this is accurate. But he was there expressing his concern over the fact that every year, at that time at least, about 6 million Muslims were becoming Christians on Al Jazeera. Now, some have said, well, he may have been exaggerating the figure in order to incite anger against Christianity on the part of Muslims. But others say, well, wait a minute. This is a Muslim telling you these things. He's not trying to do that, because if he tells you how many conversions there are from Islam, it's like saying Allah is losing the battle. So 6 million per year. You know, that equals, 16,000 conversions every day. That breaks down to 667 per hour. Now, well, let me tell you about an experience I had several years ago, actually, back in 1982. It doesn't seem all that long ago either, but it was quite a while back. I was a staff writer for a newspaper, and I pulled out this clipping from just the other day, one that I haven't looked at in a long time. Well, thank you. It is entitled, Bible Smuggler Goes Where Missions Can't. And I was sent to a meeting sponsored by some of the people who were working with Open Doors with Brother Andrew. Have you ever heard of that ministry? It's a ministry. It goes back. Brother Andrew, as he called himself, back in those days, I don't remember his full name, but back in those days, he didn't release it because there was a certain danger. He was called God's smuggler or the Bible smuggler because when he got the idea of distributing Bibles behind the Iron Curtain across communist lines, he would actually load his Volkswagen, take his suitcases, put his clothes, hide Bibles and literature in the suitcase, and then drive through the checkpoint, hoping and praying that he made it through so he could distribute this material when he got into those lands. So he did. He drove through. He would strike a conversation, tell a few jokes, laugh with the guards there at the checkpoint. They would actually open, this happened more than once, open his the trunk in the front of the Volkswagen, you know, open his suitcase, start on, you know, moving things around, and he said he's actually seen it, couldn't believe it. There was the material exposed, and these guys were talking and laughing, and they never saw it. Happened more than once. Never saw it. They closed it back, sent him on his way. Bye, see you next time. And he would go through, he would distribute this stuff, and over the years he built quite a reputation in the underground church in the communist world. Of course, they're where we know now, since the fall of communism in the former USSR, that there were millions. Oh, yeah, they had the official Orthodox church that was there under their control. But underground, figuratively speaking, there were millions of Christians. You know, Orthodox, Catholic, Evangelical, all kinds. But millions of them were there. And you know, they exist in China today. They're in China today. When I was at this meeting and I wrote this article, I told the story about how, in fact, a barge moved. I started off telling about a barge moved slowly just offshore in China. Gave the city here was a Suatou, China city in southeast China, and how they began to unload waterproof boxes. There were 232 of them, one ton crates had been waterproofed, and they were rolling them off the edge of the barge, and then it had hundreds of Chinese coming out and pulling them ashore. There were boxes full of Bibles. They were breaking them open, and you know they were trying to hurry because they knew the officials would be alerted soon. Sure enough, the officials show up. It was a partial success. They got away with a lot of the Bibles, a few hundred arrests. You know, this is contraband in a communist country to put the Bibles in storage, and then you know. I guess you can justify stealing in that case because they would come back and break into the storage building and take those Bibles, the ones that didn't go to jail. They also told the story of a woman who had been a Christian there for 33 years. But somewhere between 27 and 30 of those years, she spent in prison, in jail, because of her faith. Do you know what she did in jail? Everybody she came in contact with, she had to tell them about Jesus. And she gained a lot of converts. They didn't even have a broadcast going over there. A lot of converts just through the means such as that. And these are places where Christians are oppressed. Places where it's not easy to be a Christian. You don't get out in the street and tell everybody that you're a Christian. And this is where it is growing by leaps and bounds. With tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions every year in some of these places. So that was an interesting experience to meet with some of these people who were involved in that ministry. So that, the Jesus film, the personal testimony, all the things going on like that in these countries that are not so friendly to Christianity is what's causing all this growth. But what about all those folks in the United States who have converted to Islam? We hear about conversions to Islam, don't we? We hear about how Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, don't we? I don't buy it for a moment. I don't buy it. You see, it's growing because of immigration and because of the high birth rate. But as far as conversions, no. Only a fraction of those, the numbers that I've given to you today, only not even a significant fraction of Christians or people who have no religious faith at all or whatever, only a fraction convert to Islam. And you know what happens? You know what happens to them? According to This is according to HighScienceDiet.com. That website reports that 75% of those who convert to Islam within a few years leave it. They usually find some pretty good reasons to leave. As I said, growth of Islam is more due to high birth rates in Islamic countries and immigration than conversions. When it comes to conversion stories, though, Christianity, I maintain, is beating Islam. There's no contest. Christianity is the fastest growing religion on planet Earth. Now, what do we take away from all of this? Several things. I would say, first of all, in a world where Islamofascism is a very real threat, the military option always has to remain on the table. No doubt about that. You have nuclear weapons being developed. You have to have something to combat that. So the military option always has to be there. But the thing I wonder is it possible that they might be defeated through a different means? Maybe they'll convert. That would be a way to defeat them without the military option. It's a pleasant thought at the very least. And, you know, many people who otherwise would have been terrorists did convert, have converted. They have. The second thing is, why do they convert? Have you ever wondered about that? Why? As I was going through this material, why do they convert? Well, you know, in Islam, if you're a Muslim, you're never certain whether you have pleased Allah sufficiently so that He will allow you entrance into paradise at the end of your life. It's always that uncertainty. Have I done enough? Have I sacrificed enough? Have my sacrifices been big enough? I think that's a component of what leads some people to strap on the bombs, to make that ultimate sacrifice. As my sacrifice, has it been big enough? Will Allah, the Master, not the Father, don't call Him Father. Allah has no sons, no children. He has slaves. But will Allah allow me entrance into paradise? Always that concern. But you know, when these people who grow up with that, they grow up with the oppression of Islam, they grow up with the coercion in a religion of coercion, and then they learn of a God whose characteristics are very different from those of Allah. They learn of a God who so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. It's a God who's reaching out to humanity, not a slave master who is demanding more and more and more, and maybe you'll gain entrance into paradise. I think that's a big, big factor. A Sudanese evangelical leader put it this way. He said very simply, he said, people have seen real Islam and they want Jesus instead. That's kind of simple, but it's a fact. They encounter a different God, a God of different characteristics. And the third thing is, this tells me that there is a deep spiritual hunger in the human soul. A deep spiritual hunger. Islam simply does not fill the void. It takes something else. It takes something else. The spiritual hunger in the human soul brings me to a scripture. This is a sermon. I guess I need to have a scripture or two. And that's in John chapter 4. If you would turn there with me, John the 4th chapter. An interesting event in the ministry of Jesus. Beginning in verse 3, Jesus left Judea and departed again to Galilee. Now, if you're in Judea, that's where Jerusalem is, and you're going to Galilee, you go down a hill, but you go north. That's why they say, when they talk about going south from Galilee to Judea, that they go up to Jerusalem or up to Judea. That's because it's uphill, but actually it's south. So this says he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. So he's going north in this case. And he did something here. If you don't understand some of the cultural things going on there, some of the cultural experience of that time, you'll miss some of these things that I'm going to tell you about. said he needed to go through Samaria. Well, so, yeah, that Samaria is right between Judea and Galilee. Look at any Bible map. Needed to go through Samaria. Big deal. Oh, it was a big deal for a Jewish rabbi. You know, the really pious Jews did not go through the heart of Samaria because they perceived that they were defiled by coming in such close contact with those filthy, nasty Samaritans. So what would they do? They would travel around by way of the seashore to avoid them. Take a little longer route, the long way around, and then come up to Galilee. But Jesus went right through, cut right across and went right straight through. And he did some other things that no self-respecting Jewish rabbi, you know, from their perception, would do in those days. Let's read, see what happened. Verse 5, so he came to the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me a drink. For the disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And you think, well, okay, well, woman comes along. She's got her bucket. She drops it down in the well. Jesus says, give me a drink. So, well, what's going on there? No big deal. I would do it too if I were thirsty. Well, the thing is, you know, the Jewish rabbis of that day did not talk to women in public like that. He didn't talk to a woman. Jesus says, not only does he talk to a woman, you know, also the Jewish rabbis perceived that if you drank from the cup of a Samaritan, that you were defiled. Nasty old Samaritan. Some of those Samaritan germs on you. You didn't do that because of it brought defilement. So not only does this rabbi talk to a woman in public, in this public place, but asked her for a drink. He just kind of just ignored the rules, didn't he? Asked her for a drink. That's why it says in verse 9, then the woman of Samaria said to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. It was kind of startling to her, evidently. Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it was who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. The woman said to him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock? Jesus answered and said to her, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become to him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. The Jews of that day thought of flowing water. They looked on that as a symbol of God's activity. So obviously he's referring to this common symbol for God's activity in a person's life. You drink of this water, you won't thirst again. Verse 15, the woman said to him, sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw. You know, something else is interesting about this whole thing. It's the sixth hour, which seems to be a kind of an unusual hour for a woman to be coming to the well to get water. Normally, women came together to get water, to draw water. This woman came alone. It may be that other women in the community didn't have much to do with her because of a certain reputation. And here Jesus talks to her in public, says, give me a drink of water. Verse 16, Jesus said to her, go call your husband. Now he's setting her up here. Go call your husband and come here. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you have well said, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you are now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. You know, the idea that he could tell her all about her life like that. How did he know that? Well, he must be a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. You see, they were there at the foot of Mount Gerizim, which was the site of the ancient Samaritan temple. I'll tell you a little bit something before I proceed about the Samaritans, who they were. In 7 22 BC, the Assyrians took the northern kingdom of Israel captive. They deported them from that land. They occupied the land that came later came to be known as Samaria. Well, they were removed, deported. There evidently was a small remnant left, but they were deported. And then other captives from other nations were transplanted to replace them. Well, they brought their gods with them, all their pagan gods, apparently an assortment of them. And when they got there, they learned about Israel's God, Yahweh, and of course, this other god that Israel had begun to worship, Baal. We normally pronounce it Baal. I think the correct pronunciation is Baal or Baal. So they were not only bringing their own gods, they discovered a couple of new ones, Yahweh and Baal. So they added them. Over time, they developed, and we don't know why, perhaps due to the influence of some renegade priests who came up with the Old Testament scriptures and taught them more thoroughly. We don't know why, but they adopted over time a religion very similar to the Judaism you found down south, up south in their case. And so they had their temple, Mount Gerizim. They offered sacrifices there. You know, to this day, the Samaritans that live there still offer the Passover sacrifice there. They still kill the lamb on that mountain. So they did it. They did the sacrifices. And they had a certain knowledge. You're going to see here, they had a certain knowledge of Scripture. Now, no doubt, their knowledge of God was very incomplete and corrupted with ideas from other faiths. After all, remember, it was Simon Magus who was found there. He was a Samaritan. And I think some of his beliefs didn't really coincide very well with Christianity or Judaism, for that matter. So here they were, an incomplete and imperfect knowledge of God. They didn't have everything the Jews in Judea had. But at least they understood something about the God of the Hebrews, the God of Abraham. They understood something about His laws and so on. Let's read on. Verse 20 says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Jesus said to her, 'Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews.'" Of course, God had given the Jews the oracles. God had promised that He would send the Messiah through the tribe of Judah. Of course, salvation is through the Jews, through the tribe of Judah, because Jesus Himself is a Judite. He says, "You don't know what you worship." You obviously had an imperfect knowledge of God, less perfect than the Jews, and they didn't have the best knowledge by this time. He says, "But the hour is coming," verse 23, "and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth." Why does he say at this point, God is spirit? Well, because you see, he's just talked about two places of worship, the temple in Jerusalem. The temple that once stood on Mount Gerizim, two places. He's essentially saying you can't put God in a place. You can't put God in a box, as it were, in a temple. God is spirit. It means he's universal. He's everywhere. He can be reached from any point on this earth. He said the time has come. The time is coming, and now is. Now is because the Messiah was there. When people will worship him in spirit and truth, wherever they are, not just in Jerusalem, not just on Gerizim. He continues, verse 25, "The woman said to him, 'I know that Messiah is coming.'" You see, this tells that she knew something about the coming of Messiah. Evidently, there was I read someplace that there was a Samaritan tradition concerning Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. We're not going to turn there, but that's where Moses said, "The Lord your God will raise up a prophet like me. You will listen to him." And they took that to mean, well, this is talking about this anointed one to come, the Christ, or the Messiah. They'd heard about that. And they interpreted it that way. So, and that's why she says then, "I know that Messiah is coming," who's called Christ. "When he comes, he will tell us all things." In other words, he will finish what Moses started. Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." And he didn't say, no, no, that's another Jesus. That's the false Christ. I said, I'm the one. I'm him. Prophet like Moses. That's kind of unusual. Normally he didn't reveal his identity, but to her he did. And what happens after this is very interesting. It says, at this point, disciples came and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, who do you seek? Or what do you seek? Or why are you talking with her? In other words, they kept their mouth shut. The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the men, this is the Samaritan men, come see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? Then they went out of the city and came to him. In the meantime, his disciples urged him, saying, Rabbi, eat. But he said to them, I have food to eat which you do not know. It says, in the meantime. In other words, before they actually arrived there. Now here they are on their way. His disciples are urging him to eat. He said to them, verse 32, I have food to eat of which you do not know. Therefore the disciples said to one another, Has anyone brought him anything to eat? They didn't quite get what he was talking about. Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. In other words, he's saying something more satisfying than just eating physical food is taking place here. And he calls it his Father's work. Let's see what he's talking about specifically. Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields. Now remember at this point, the Samaritans, the woman who had gone back and told the men of Samaria about this man who might be the Christ. And if you literally looked up and looked across the field towards the city, no doubt you would see the approach of this crowd of Samaritans. So he says here, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they're already white for harvest, meaning they are ripe for harvest as the Samaritans approached. And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. For in this the saying is true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labors. Who could have done it? Well, maybe John the Baptist, sent to prepare the way before him. They probably heard of John the Baptist, knew something about Messiah from him, their own traditions about Messiah, their own understanding of the prophet like Moses. Others had planted the seed in some way or another, and now he says you're going to reap that. And the point he's going to get at here is you don't have to, like, you know how it is when you farm? The farmer goes out and sows the seed, and then he waits. 4 months till the harvest or whatever. Well, he says it's not quite like that in this harvest. You see, the sowing of the seed and the reaping can go on simultaneously. And many of the Samaritans of that city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified. He told me all that I ever did. I guess you could say that was kind of their Jesus film. Well, they had the real deal here. So when the Samaritans had come to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word. And they said, then they said to the woman, now we believe not because of what you said, for we ourselves have heard him, and we know that this indeed is the Christ, the Savior of the world. Now I read that, I think, once again, that this is the hunger in the human heart. These Samaritans came out there because they were looking for something more than what their religions had offered to them. This hungering of the human soul for meaning in life. Some knowledge of Messiah, but not knowing the full story, still didn't after this, but now they were finding something that was satisfying. So I can say from this that, you know, even though we hear that Islam is a real threat, and it is Islamofascism, even though we hear of the great numbers in Europe of how Christianity is on the demise, it's all but a dead religion, perhaps taking its final gasp, and Islam is on the rise, and we can become distressed, and we can become discouraged. look around the world at Sudan and various other places in the world and see the brutality of Islam. Think of the possibility of what might happen here as far as a terrorist attack, and someday maybe even nuclear terrorism, who knows. We can think of all these things, and yet at the same time we can look around and we can see evidence of this hungering that's in the human soul. We see the evidence through the many thousands and millions of conversions in the Islamic world and other places of oppression in the world to Christianity. And because of that, I can say, lift up your eyes and look at the fields. They're ripe for harvest.